at my feet here, which feels familiar. So my name is Richard Meyer, and I'm very honored to be here and very moved by this occasion, which I think is extremely important. So thank you to the organizers of this and to all of the feminist scholars, artists, writers, curators, past and present, who have made it possible. This paper places the feminist future in dialogue with particular episodes from the feminist past. It begins, or I begin, with a passage from an unpublished letter by the poet Audrian Rich from March of 1974. Quote, the other day I opened my mail and it was some literature from Amnesty International, including a Xerox of a letter from a hostage who had been finally tortured to death, a man. I found myself weeping for that man and in rage against the men who control the world. And I think those tears were as feminist as any I've shed. The artist Martha Rossler recently returned in two different senses to her brilliant series of photo montages, Bringing the War Home, House Beautiful, originally created in the years between 1967 and 72, and distributed as photocopied flyers at anti-war rallies and as reproductions in the feminist and underground press. In December 2004, Rossler exhibited an edition set of prints made from the original negatives of the montages, one of which I'm showing you on the left. Among these were Tron Amputee, in which the maimed body of a Vietnamese woman has been cut out and inserted into a mod interior with wall-to-wall carpeting, hexagonal ceiling, and exposed wooden beams. Tron's war-torn body cannot but fit uneasily within, the space, I'm just gonna relax. Doesn't matter, you know. It's Martha Rossler, so you must know these images. I hope you know these images for your own sake. They're incredibly important. Tron's war-torn body, I said that. Rather than being seated on a cushy couch in the den, Tron is pushed all the way to the otherwise empty foreground of the page, as though the distance between fore and background had been stretched to the point of virtual irreconcilability. As Tron outstrips the border of the page, and thus of the room, the integrity of her body is once again cut off and cut up. Rossler returned to Bringing the War Home in another sense by creating a new series of montages in response to the war in Iraq, a series exhibited alongside the Vietnam montages. Drawing on the same cut-and-paste technique rather than Photoshop, Rossler introduces the visual traces of captivity, torture, interrogation, and bombing to the glossy pages of contemporary fashion and shelter magazines. In Hooded Captives, a blonde glamazon in a white jumpsuit and electric yellow fur coat strides down the bright orange floor of a sleek interior. In the foreground, two hunched and hooded figures, hands bound behind their backs, kneel with their heads bowed low to the ground. The posture they have been forced to assume at once recalls and perverts the kneeling or sajda position of Islamic daily prayer, in which the supplicant lowers his or her forehead to the earth. The mobility and apparent freedom of the white woman are contrasted not only with the bound captives in the foreground, but also with the crucifixion photograph from Abu Ghraib on the cover of Time magazine in the background. A cover whose black and red color scheme nicely, which is to say chillingly, matches the black red leather and red frame sofa that sits nearby. Both of these works were included in Rossler's one-person show in late 2004 at Gorney, Braven & Lee, a New York gallery that has since closed. In the first week of January 2005, as I walked across that gallery's dark concrete floors to examine each montage. And you can see, these are unofficial installation shots that that were kindly provided to me, but this is Hooded Captives, and this is Tron. As I walked across the floors, I remember thinking how different this West this West Chelsea context and cultural moment were from those that marked the initial circulation of Bringing the War Home in the late 1960s and early 70s. I'm showing you the back and front covers of the third issue of Goodbye to All That, a woman's newspaper founded in San Diego in the fall of 1970, one to which Rosler occasionally submitted drawings and page designs such as the back cover. Unsigned, generally unsigned. The front page reports on the Chicano liberation of Neighborhood House, a community center in the predominantly Mexican-American district of Logan Heights that had become a largely white-run administrative center devoid of social services such as community food distribution and safe playground space. On October 5, 1970, members of the Brown Berets occupied Neighborhood House and barricaded themselves inside as a means of claiming it for the Chicano community. And this photograph shows Mexican-American children on the porch of the newly liberated center. Goodbye to All That covered Chicano activism and the anti-war movement not as supplements or sidebars to women's liberation, but as necessary extensions of it. In the newspaper's first issue, the editorial collective All Women Collective declared, quote, "We view women's liberation as part of the struggle of other people. That true liberation can only be achieved when workers, blacks, Chicanos, and homosexuals are free to fully develop their capacities as human beings. We believe that this presupposes a radical restructuring of society, including the creation of alternatives to the nuclear family and an end to the exploitation of human labor for profit." I'm just showing you several different covers. You see there was a change in design toward a more slightly more tabloid format and the introduction of two colors by the time we're in 1972. Goodbye to All That recalls an activist culture of underground newspapers, manifestos, sit-ins, and street protests, and of radical coalitions built, however tenuously, across lines of class, language, generation, and gender. It also bespeaks the revolutionary ambitions of women's liberation to remake virtually every aspect of society, from local community centers to global conflicts, from housing to daycare to education to the wage labor system. In a recently published essay in the important anthology, Women Artists at the Millennium, Martha Rosler notes, quote, "Women artists are tarnished and in most instances slandered by the suggestion that the first time around, in the foundational moment of the late 60s and early 70s, in the foundational moment of the late 60s through the 70s, women were agitating only for themselves, white middle-class women." And you can see, or I don't know if you can make it out, but I'm just showing you coverage that this is the Valentine's Day issue from 1971, and it's about the imprisonment of women by romantic ideologies of heterosexuality and femininity. But there's also coverage of Angela Davis's incarceration. This is about the sex trade in Vietnamese women, and it's subtitled The Americanization of Saigon, and so forth. As in Rosler's, okay, the revolution sought by Rosler and the other women of Goodbye to All That did not, as we all know, come to pass. But the visual and material traces of that moment, including its artworks and ephemera, its newspapers and manifestos, might help us to imagine a different set of possibilities from those that prevail today, whether in the art world or in the big world beyond it. And I have not yet seen it, but I'm encouraging, would encourage everyone to see here Documenting a Feminist Past, Art World Critique, curated by Jenny Tobias, which is in the library and archives, and includes, I'm told, archival and ephemera material from the feminist movement. As in Rosler's art, Such a return to the feminist past requires both a revival of previous strategies, bringing the war home through cut-and-paste collage, and an updating of them for a new moment. So new technologies of torture that are represented in these works that are specific to to the war in Iraq. This is Amputee Election 2 from 2004, and we see Jeb and George W. Bush yucking it up on a flat-screen TV, while a less fortunate white man, presumably an American soldier, with a prosthetic leg and medical sensors attached to his body, walks away from the projected image of the commander-in-chief and baby brother. In the distance, the fires of Fallujah or Haditha or Baghdad continue to rage. I think we need to reckon with Rossler's work and with that of other feminist artists, both in the pages of Goodbye to All That and in the galleries of West Chelsea, both as a remnant of the radical past and as an active critique of the present. Linda Nochlin recently argued that, also in Women Artists at the Millennium, I suggest you buy that book, recently argued that since 9/11, quote, certain patriarchal values are making a comeback, as they invariably do during times of stress and conflict. To the examples Nochlin provides, I would add a recent New York Times report on the invasion of the alpha male Democrat, an invasion successfully plotted by the party's recruitment of macho candidates for congressional election last November. According to a Democratic Party official cited in the article, quote, we went to CIA agents, FBI agents, NFL quarterbacks, sheriffs, Iraq war vets. These are red-blooded Americans who are tough. This piece appeared less than 1 week after Nancy Pelosi was sworn in as the first female speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Even as a Democratic congresswoman made feminist history, the Democratic Party and the New York Times produced a counter-narrative of political power embodied by a tough guy caucus of alpha male warriors, athletes, and former G-men. The gung-ho glorification of manliness and militarism, as we can see from the alpha male Democrats, flows not only from the political right, but from the left as well, or what's left of the left. Within the context of the early 1970s, a major obstacle to feminist attempts to partner with other radical left movements was the sexism of the men who typically dominated those movements. The very title of the newspaper, Goodbye to All That, for example, cites Robin Morgan's 1970 manifesto of the same name, in which she launched a fierce critique of what she called the cock privilege of the male-dominated left, including the Students for Democratic Society, the New Ecology Movement, the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, and the Gay Liberation Front, all of which, as Morgan saw it, reproduced male supremacy, even as they claimed to be fighting for revolutionary change. And just because I love it so much, I'm showing you a cartoon that originally accompanied Robin Morgan's article in RAT, which was the first issue of RAT that was seized by women as a critique of the sexism of the men on the editorial board of RAT. And it says, bye bye, baby, bye bye. And you can see the ship that is the male dominated left going down, and maybe to be, you know, replaced by women on waves. This is a quote, and I liked it. I liked it pointing to the sheriff and all those alpha male Democrats, whoever that guy is, Stephen Croninger. I think he has a maybe unconscious feminist critique. If you notice the way in which he's deforming these guys' bodies, it's sort of an interesting collage. Anyway, this is a quote from Robin Morgan from Goodbye to All That: a genuine left does not function as a microcosm of capitalist economy, with men competing for power and status at the top and women doing all the work at the bottom and functioning as objectified prizes or coin as well. Goodbye to all that. In the time remaining, I will look briefly at two episodes in early 1970s feminist activism that have been largely lost to history. The first involves a link between radical feminism and queer-identified men, which was inspired directly by Robin Morgan and writings, The Red Stockings, and writings such as Goodbye to All That. In 1971, three gay men, or as they preferred to be called, flaming faggots, renounced all forms of male supremacy in the name of what they called revolutionary effeminism. Effeminism sought to support women by, for example, providing free daycare to mothers, single mothers especially, without entering or intervening in the women's movement, because they felt that men would not, that they would not be able to help themselves, but intrude or take over if they actually entered the women's movement. So they wanted to be supporters in whatever ways they could without actually becoming participants in particular women's groups, which they felt should be all women. And so this was specifically a kind of activism directed at other gay men or would-be flaming faggots to understand that, as the effeminists put it, saw it, that women's liberation was the key to all human freedom. This is an amazing page from Faggotry. This is a poster flyer designed by Stephen Dansky. Stephen Dansky, by the way, was the recipient of the letter from Adrian Rich that I quoted at the beginning of my talk. This is an amazing page about what it means to effeminate. And you can see it includes things like the struggle to become unmanly, to become non-competitive, to share, to raise children, to be vulnerable, to be able to cry for and with someone else, not to tell women what they should do about their movement, not to oppose the strength, anger, and power of women, not to be divisive of the love women have for each other, not to become passive or paralyzed in our struggle to change. And then lastly, and only lastly, something specifically about faggots, to fight against our oppression as faggots in militant ways. Where the effeminists sought to disavow their own cock privilege, a number of contemporaneous women artists insisted upon their right to depict the sexualized male body or otherwise lay claim to phallic imagery. Among these were Anita Steckel, an artist whose Giant Woman series featured a monumental female nude, or in one case, an updated Mona Lisa, moving through and towering over the public space of New York City. That's New Mona Takes the Brush on the left lower hand side, and Giant Woman on Empire State. In a related series of New York skyline paintings, the city literally becomes a phallic landscape as erect penises perch atop Manhattan skyscrapers. Men seem to own the city, Steckel would later recall, and this was my way of responding to that. All of these works were in Steckel's one-woman show at Rockland Community College in 1972, which she entitled The Feminist Art of Sexual Politics. A county legislator, male, sought to close the show down and to convince the local district attorney to charge Steckel with pandering obscenity. The ensuing controversy was covered by the New York papers as well as by a newscast on public television. I'm going to show you a 3-minute clip from this public television newscast.
Thank you.
Following on her experience in Rockland County, Anita Steckel founded the Fight Censorship Group in 1973, a collective of women artists, quote, who have done, will do, or do some form of sexually explicit art. Members of the group included Hannah Wilkie, Louise Bourgeois, Juanita McNeely, Eunice Golden, Joan Semmel, Judith Bernstein, and Martha Edelheit, some of whom I know are here today. And that's the order in which I'm showing you them here, with Anita on the top left. At their inaugural meeting, Steckel read a manifesto that denounced the double standard whereby females are shown, quote, females are shown in a seductive, sexual, and nude manner in the very same museums that refuse to show the sexual male nude. An unforgettable quote concludes the document, quote, from Anita Steckel's manifesto. If the erect penis is not wholesome enough to go into museums, it should not be considered wholesome enough to go into women. And if the erect penis is wholesome enough to go into women, then it is more than wholesome enough to go into the greatest art museums. With its startling, end quote, juxtaposition of museum practice and heterosexual penetration, this passage became something of a signature statement for the FC Fight Censorship Group. In it, Steckel bluntly insists that the museum open itself to phallic imagery by female artists, and more broadly, to the sexually explicit expressions of women. The Fight Censorship Group made public appearances on cable television and at colleges and universities to raise consciousness about women artists and the struggle for freedom of expression. For a 1973 appearance at the New School here in New York, FC group members brought examples of their actual work rather than slides or photostats to the stage. So you see Eunice Golden on the upper left discussing her male landscape painting, expressionist male nude, Purple Sky. Louise Bourgeois holding her phallic sculpture called Fillette, which means little girl, which is actually now in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Judith Bernstein, with, you could just see the Anita's giant woman on New York in behind Judith Bernstein, an unidentified man. And then Joan Semmel and Anita Steckel here with two unidentified men presenting Semmel's Red, White, and Blue. And I want to talk for a moment about Joan Semmel, and then I'm done. Originally an abstract painter, Semmel used high contrast colors to defamiliarize scenes of heterosexuality, as well as unexpected angles, croppings, and monumental scale to unsettle the conventions of commercial porn. The resulting paintings embodied a sense of sexual specificity, e.g., a woman fingers the space between her lover's spread legs, male lover's spread legs, with a vivid anti-natural palette. The woman is painted pale lavender, the man olive green with bits of yellow. For these paintings, Semmel shot her own photographs of a couple having sex or about to have sex. She did this because she did not want her erotic series, that's what she called the paintings, to be based on pre-existing photographs taken for the purposes of male pleasure, but rather on her own first-hand view, a woman's view, through the lens of the camera, of sexual contact and combination. And in the paintings, there's no context, no fetish objects, as you can see. It really is about the formal and erotic combinations that bodies make. According to Semmel's own account of the works, I was not interested in simply reversing the position of male and female in objectifying the male body in the way that the female body has been used for so long. I did not want to romanticize the sexual experience, but to develop a language whereby a woman could express her own desires, whatever they might be, without shame or sentimentality. Even as Semmel moved away from the scenes of other people's sexual activity, and I'm showing you the very first painting where she moved away, and she literally is moving away. You see one of the erotic series on the wall, against the wall in the backdrop, and she is painting her own view of her body holding a cup of coffee. And this was, although Joan has been very kind to let me show you this painting, because she thinks of it as transitional and doesn't show it publicly, but this, I love this painting because it's the moment where you can literally see Semmel turning away from the sex of other people and toward her own embodiment. And then from there on out, many, many of her paintings will be self-portraits exactly from her view, her perspective of her own body, as you see below. But even as she did that, even as she turned to the self, she remained committed to the sexually forthright work of other women. She organized the show, designed the poster, schlepped, you know, the works back to the Museum of Contemporary Women, Consciousness, and Content to coincide with Linda Nochlin and Anne Sutherland Harris's Women Artists 1550 to 1950 at the Brooklyn Museum. Okay, so I asked Joan Semmel, why do you think this conference is so popular? Why is there so much interest in, right now in museum exhibition, upcoming museum exhibitions in writing, and in this overflow audience here at the Museum of Modern Art? Joan Semmel's response was that perhaps people want more, want art to mean something again, something more than the market, more than the next Wonder Boy painter, more than Miami Basel. And I think that this desire, I would add to that the importance of MoMA as an institutional site, both for forging a dominant view of modern and contemporary art, but also a history, as we heard from the Guerrilla Girls, of it as a site of contestation, especially around the issue of the underrepresentation of women artists. And this is women marching on MoMA in April of 1972, in a photograph by Chuck Nemser. I have focused today on three women artists who have sustained a commitment to feminism throughout more than 35 years of art and activism. Each of these three women, this is a recent Anita Steckel piece called Macho Christianity, and a Martha Rossler piece from the Bringing the War Home New series. Each of these women, along with so many others, both here in this hall today and far beyond it, continue to produce feminist work in defiance of the market dictates, political amnesia, and professional self-interest that so often structures the contemporary art world. Joan Semmel has said of her work that it concerns the reality of desire, and the inevitability of aging. Issues which have not, to my knowledge, been of much concern in the glossy pages of New York art magazines or the blue chip galleries of, say, Larry Gagosian. According to the critic Jerry Saltz, today's art scene is, quote, like high school with money, by which he means, I believe, that it is trendy, immature, and overcapitalized. Well, if we're back in high school, then for me at least, it is the senior women. Women such as Martha Rossler, Anita Steckel, and Joan Semmel, who will provide the inspiration necessary either to graduate or to drop out.